Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
In this community, the way it goes, you email somebody, can you tell me about XYZ? The answer comes, this is my phone number, I'm around at 3, call me. Because nobody trusts each other.
In last week's episode of IDN, the first of three on the formation of arbitral tribunals with former arbitrator and University of Dundee professor Thomas Walde, who passed away in October 2008, we discussed the dynamics that take place once a tribunal is appointed. This week, we take one step back from a tribunal having been formed as Thomas illustrates the considerations that can go into assessing potential arbitrators, including how parties might conduct some of their due diligence on candidates when there's a paucity of data to help predict their likely performance as arbitrators, or to identify any informal relationships they may have with parties and counsel. We start this discussion with some of the basic considerations of what a party may be thinking when appointing an arbitrator. Common law or civil continental background, for example, and what might be called politically incorrect or taboo subjects, such as whether there are relevant gender or age differences among arbitrators.
Generally, this, I think the idea is you take an English QC when you want a literal interpretation of texts and not much fuss about morality, ethics, fairness, justice. You take a more rather continental when you want to get kind of a purposive interpretation of text going beyond the text, negotiation history, good faith.
You and I have very different views of this. I mean, I think you take an English QC when you want much more of a witness-oriented, much more, you know, a lot more disclosure and discovery type of proceeding, and you want to move the proceedings in that direction, and you go with a continental if you want a much more efficient, document-driven sort of proceeding. That's the way from a party perspective.
The English lawyers now are moving more to this kind of document-driven. I mean, lots of the mannerisms, like that you read your whole pleading, you know, you have to read it out. But I found...
Which you're not seeing as much as with the North Americans.
You don't, yeah. But I understand with the English, also the English law reforms. But generally, when you go to English arbitrators now, you see that they are actually ready to accept like written testimonies. Is there something specific about women arbitrators? You know, nobody in politically correct language is always kind of, you're supposed to see everything gender neutral. But then the genders do have often a typical behavior is different. I mean, what is your experience? I mean, do you find that women are different? Are they kind of more conscientious? It might be a positive. On the other hand, you might see, are they, if you annoy them, do they tend to be more vindictive?
You know, we've had a number of women arbitrators over the years, and I can't think of a single instance in which we thought that they were anything but very hardworking.
My experience with women is I would assume that they are more conscientious.
More conscientious
and harder working. First, that women perhaps are more conscientious.
Well, right.
They can probably, supposedly, they can do more multitasking.
No, maybe that there's also recognition that they're in a minority.
So they have to work harder.
I can think of several. There was appointments where we had women arbitrators and. Certainly, but whether as party appointed or as chairs, they did their effort to move the proceedings.
Where did you find them more difficult than men?
I don't think any area we found them more difficult than men. Mm-hmm. I think if anything, I will tell you where we've had problems with it hadn't occurred to me till now, but where we found laziness as being a problem, it's been with men, you know, very successful, very well regarded arbitrators who are men.
Are you, now this is again is a taboo subject, but are the nationalities where gender you have found in your experience more lazy people? Or is it your criterion currently as I see it, old, successful, that means doesn't have to work hard, doesn't have to run that fast, feels he's a big shot, and that's he does you a favor. Well, I can see that person to be more lazy than someone who is up and coming and who's hungry still.
I'll tell you that I used to have, or sometime I had almost a generational bias where I felt that I wasn't going to appoint anyone over 60 after a number of bad experiences with arbitrators who just were resting on their laurels and didn't feel that they had to move things along. Recently appointed an arbitrator who was 70 at the time of the appointment, and I have to tell you, I've never, Southern European, from a Southern European country, I've never seen anybody as vigorous and as conscientious in representing, you know, making sure that the proceedings got up and underway and that a chair was delivered that was consistent with the expectations that we'd explained at the outset. I hate to go back to what I said earlier. You can't say it depends, but I think it depends.
You know, what I always kind of, these are questions, when I do my due diligence for my clients on arbitrators, I do. But if I'm involved in appointing an arbitrator, I look at their, I can tell you how I will look at them. I will look at what they've written. I will see if they've been in arbitral tribunal awards, which one can read or I can get. I will Google them. I will then Google them against the other arbitrators or the chair on the panel to see what their relation. I actually have a theory that by Googling, you can identify networks. What I always do very much is so to say, I do almost network plotting, you see. I don't do it in a very scientific way. You know, I understand some people or someone wants to do it in scientific way, even with a computer, but I use, in essence, Googling. Like, if I want to find out if you're my co-arbitrator, I'm the co-arbitrator, let's change our scenario. We're negotiating here about the appointment of a third arbitrator. You're coming with XYZ. I will now Google Michael McElrath, and then I will Google XYZ. And if it shows up 40 times, generally I think it typically shows up, you've gone to conferences together. If it shows 40 times, and perhaps I will Google you against other candidates, and if you and the other candidates are 5-6 times, and that one chap and you is 40 times, I will assume there is more than, there is quite a proximity because you may be. So this is one way of my my network plotting. The other way is then I that's just by Googling. The other way is by my interviewing technique. I will try to find out, so to say, I will find out who are the people you think highly of, who are the people who think highly of you, who are the people you don't get along with whom did you have a fight. So I will almost put you onto a map of personal relationships, and then I will, like a spider net, I will then try to show, almost like pipelines, so to say, see how, where are your important links.
You know, it's interesting. The first person on the list, when I was discussing with him the appointment of a particular chair, I named a couple of people, and one of them, he said, no, I don't get along with him.
Yeah. Well, I've said to people, if you retain me with this arbitrator, I'll be the kiss of death for you. So I said, don't retain me. I should be honest, this is not good for you. For a well-working arbitral tribunal, you want objectively the two parties, a good team. But if you want to appoint your co-arbitrator or the chairman and you've already got a co-arbitrator, you certainly have to think of the personal chemistry here. Now, in the cases where I've appointed the chairman with my co-arbitrator, the person we appointed, I think, is where the two of us, both thought we had a particular, so to say, inroad. And as I told you, the moment we agreed, I tried to call that person, but he was already busy with my co-arbitrator, who wanted to congratulate him on being appointed, on getting, you know, his brownie points.
Well, before you could congratulate
him. Yeah. No, I was trying, but I was a little bit slower. Now, and that's kind of interesting. That's kind of my formal level, the easy level, which I can do rapidly because it's done by internet, by my next level is then the very work intensive, and it's more expensive for a client if they retain me because it takes a lot of time. I will then use my network. I will then ask people whom I think who have dealt with him or her, or I know that they've been together on tribunals or somebody has been counsel. I will then sometimes email, but typically the email in this community, the way it goes, you email somebody, can you tell me about XYZ? The answer comes, this is my phone number, I'm around at 3, call me. Nobody wants to say right. anything in writing because nobody trusts each other because they all think they say something negative and they think it may be forwarded to that person because there's also a lot of competitiveness, backbiting, backstabbing going on. Or suddenly you may ask a question and put someone else as a blind copy. There are all sorts of things. So the careful arbitrator will, particularly the arbitrator, will then say, call me, and that means, or give me the phone number.
Which probably means that there's some negative information.
Well, not necessarily. They're just, these arbitrators, starting with the first one, they're just very careful. And so you call, I mean, sometimes you get a response by email, but like in job interviews and references, if you are very serious and do it well, you have to call. And so I will call. And in the talk, we will find out more and more about them. However, what I've also found is normal in life, you call two people and you get two different views. But if you get one view is predominant, you know what the community thinks of somebody. But generally, my system of due diligence on arbitrators is first the written, or the mechanical things, but then is the phone calling and talking to people, which is way time consuming, but you do tend to find out things.
Okay,
you know, it's like so to say, there is a theory you can infer how somebody makes love by dancing with them, but I think to infer from the way somebody speaks and writes, it is helpful. Yeah. But I would find speaking and publication says more about a person who has done a lot of arbitration than someone who hasn't. And it isn't, you know, until you, so to say, go into bed and see someone under the pressure and in the heat and in the particular arbitral situation, I think these outer things, like conferences and speeches, they are really, they're like a car being advertised, but you haven't been sitting in the car and driving it, to use another metaphor. And in that case,
that's a metaphor I feel more comfortable speaking about on a family rated podcast.
But yes, well, think of my analogy between dancing and sex. But in that case, I feel it would be essential, really, to see people who've worked with that person.
Next week, we conclude this short series as Thomas and I review a list of names of arbitrators being considered as potential candidates for chair in a hypothetical international arbitration.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.